Okay, welcome everybody. It's really, really nice to see you all and certainly returning faces. I'm glad I haven't scared too many people away over the course of my first two lectures. I'm going to do mostly the same format, but I'd like to try one little thing a little bit different, which is I am trying to get, you know, I'm a teacher for many years and Zoom is new for me. And it is really a challenge to kind of speak out into space and not quite get feedback. So I'm going to ask just a couple questions. And if you're comfortable, only if you're comfortable to maybe have a response or two on the chat group. It's been great afterwards looking over the chats and even after this year ends, thinking about some of the things that people said. But if, you know, you're not comfortable with that, that's fine as well. Okay, so I'm going to disappear for a second and pull up my PowerPoint as I did in the past. I think it's worked well. And okay, I'm just starting the PowerPoint properly. Okay, good. If people can give me just mention for a second, everything's going well. You can see the screen and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. And if I can't ask you to mute from this point forward, I will ask a couple questions for the chat, but I won't be looking at the chat until the end of this year. So where are we? We're the third part of what is a four-part series. I will tell you, I'm holding back. There's lots more material that I would love to go to, and maybe one day there'll be an opportunity to expand on some of these topics. But we've talked in the first part about defining desire and how specific we can get about the Eitz HaDaat. In the second shiur, we talked about creation and gender, and these were all very abstract issues. We dealt with a lot of kind of theory. We were reading text in Bereishit, but we weren't talking about a lot of dynamics. We touched upon Sarah and Abraham. We talked about Yaakov and his wives. But today we're going to kind of dive down into what people think about much more classically when we think about a shiur about sexuality in Tanakh and the challenges, the temptations, the pulls and pushes to do with sexuality. And we're going to focus our shiur today on the wayward woman. In Hebrew, that's the Isha Sota. We'll be looking at texts. We'll be mostly doing them in English. There'll be less of a close read like we did in the previous two shiurim classes. And in the last class, please God, next week, I'll be talking about culture and sexuality. And you might be able to guess where I'm going a little bit from the title. And this class is going to actually be an important transition into talking about culture and sexuality more generally. The idea of the sexual field as I develop it today, I hope will really set up next week's class. So in general, both of them stood alone, and it's true this will also stand alone, but it will be helpful to part three and part four will work together. Okay. One really quick point. I know I'm having trouble letting this go, but way back in the first year, I made the claim that the Eitz HaDaat, the tree of knowledge, was best understood as an apple. And the reason I said that was not because I had any great insight or I was following much of the medieval painting. I was corrected that the Sistine Chapel actually does the fig. But what I meant, I want to say just a little bit more clearly today. When you think about a fruit, and that's all the Torah says, it talks about fruit, doesn't give you any names. My point was the generic fruit, the undefined fruit is an apple. And I realized I could prove it linguistically. In French, potato is pomme de terre, the fruit, the apple of the ground. In Hebrew, an orange is a tapuz, known as tapuach zahav, the golden apple. Meaning the apple is always the kind of generic fruit which gets modified by something else. So a pine apple in English, a pomegranate, the apple of seeds. That's the whole point. I'm going to leave it now, and we're going to jump into what we're talking about. In the past, I have been careful to talk about I'm looking at closed captions. And I hope that works for me. I'm going to close it. I hope that doesn't close it for everybody. I haven't seen that before. If that's a problem, let me know. But I don't want to obscuring my screen, but I hope it works for you. Okay. This is a very fraught and sensitive topic. Because of that, I really do need people to be generous, meaning give me and the Torah the benefit of a doubt. Not that I'm synonymous with the Torah, but we will be saying things that people might initially object to, people might find difficult in the way it's being framed or stated. My desire is certainly to let the Torah speak for itself and perhaps even frame it in a way in which we can see it as more applicable, more modern, more sensitive than perhaps some of us have in the past. But I do need a certain amount of cooperation for that to work. We are in gendered language, hims and hers. The Torah is speaking about also it's Hebrew by definition is a gendered language. Where I can be more general and not be specific, I will attempt. But in general, I will speak in a gendered language. Again, we are adopting the heteronormative frame. I do recognize, as I said before, that that may not be shared by everyone out there, but that is the frame within which we will be operating today. We will be speaking about sexuality in an open, direct manner. And again, we'll be making comparisons, and I think this might be even more acute today. When you compare sexuality to eating an apple, that is not the same as saying that the object of sexuality is an apple. So we'll be making analogies, comparing without equating. Okay, sexual fields and the wayward woman. What does that mean? There's two big ideas that I really want to develop with you. And it's going to happen in stages and in several different senses do I mean this idea of sexual fields. But if we talk about the wayward woman, we're talking about an ordeal. An ordeal is goes, you know, common in the Middle Ages, was a test. And here I would like you, if you don't mind, to respond. How many of you, when I say the wayward woman or the sota ordeal, what is your first impression? Is it positive? Is it negative? I will venture that most people think about an ordeal as like a witch trial, something unfair, something abusive, something that involves shaming, something which is intrinsically irrational, a way for people who had no idea what was going on to grasp at something. The ordeal of cold water, actually going back to the Hammurabi code, was if a man suspected his wife of adultery, he would throw her into a river. If she survived, she's innocent. And if she drowns, then she was guilty. That's the nature of ordeals that we think about, something primitive and cruel. There is a particular African tribe that would test people by having them eat a poisoned nut. If they threw it up, they were innocent. If they died from poisoning, they were guilty. So the first impression could naturally be something negative. If you write in the chat, let me know what your first impression is. I would also curious how many people have heard about it, are familiar with this chapter in the Torah, chapter 4 in the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers. Because we're going to be reviewing it. And in general, I am... it's good for me to know who's out there and how much background to fill in. And I'm assuming a range over here, so I will try to fill in the background, but also go much deeper for people who are already familiar. So this idea of taking her and letting her hair go and sort of shaming her in public is the sort of immediate sense. There's an image of it right there. And my suspicions are most people have a negative reaction to it. There are two ways generally that people apologize for the wayward woman. One is to historicize it. And what I mean by that is they look backwards and they say, well, for its time, against the other options that were available, the idea of this ordeal is pretty good. Meaning if the other option is things that happen in certain cultures, even today, honor killings, if there's even a suspicion that someone in your family has been adulterous, specifically the women in your family, your sister, your daughter, your wife, so then they are summarily executed. And if the Torah is saying, okay, we have a better solution to that, let's take it to the temple and deal it that way. So that's an improvement against a certain barbarism. But the problem with historicizing is you're essentially saying it was good for then, but not good for now. And I'm going to attempt to do something which makes it understandable even in today's concept, even in our more progressive understanding of the position of men and women. The other possibility is to neutralize it and say it really didn't mean to work. It was a threat. It was a psychological sort of theatrical performance that basically got a woman admit to her guilt. And that's what it was there for. I'm going to try a third approach today. And my other main question is, at the end, I would like to know whether I have been successful in rehabilitating the story of the wayward woman, sexual fields, and Jewish marriage. So we're going to take a step back here for a moment and talk about Jewish marriage in general. I want to compare it, first of all, to what the Rambam says was the prevalent non-Jewish practice at a time. And the Rambam codifies this because in a fully formed halachic sovereignty, when we are supposed to have a state in which Torah can be fully embodied, fully enacted, then there will be non-Jews living among us who will have their own seven mitzvahs of Noach. And the question is, how and what are their definitions of marriage? So the Rambam says as follows. A non-Jew had relations with a maidservant who he united with his slave is executed because of the prohibition of having relations, which means the Rambam says a non-Jewish person is guilty of adultery if all he's done is taken a maidservant under his auspices and mated it with his slave and made a union over there, but violated the union by sleeping with the maidservant himself. So there's something quite amazing here. Something as unlegal, fairly soft in terms of definition, results in a marriage and the prohibition and the execution of adultery. He is not culpable unless it was publicly known that she belonged to such and such a slave, meaning there has to be some kind of public knowledge. So if there is a concept of marriage among non-Jews, even among slaves in a person's household, then there has to be a way of terminating that relationship, of saying that is permitted afterwards. So when is she permitted? When he separates her from his slave and shakes loose her hair in the market. So already we see this idea of loose hair being a statement of freedom, of being unencumbered, and it's out there in the market. And that's divorce. When is one of their married women considered like one of our divorcees? From the time he expels her from his house and sends her off on her own, or from, get this, from when she leaves on her own from his property. Gentiles do not have a written bill of divorce, and the matter is not dependent upon him alone. Rather, whether he or she wishes to separate, they may separate. No fault divorce. Completely, liberal, we might say, in our own conceptions. He can leave, she can leave. All that matters is some kind of public acknowledgement that they are together or they're no longer together. Against this is a Jewish marriage. What has it added? So before we jump into the Jewish marriage, I'd like to talk about two possible poles. The first pole is the loosest marriage we can imagine. And that lustis marriage is what we just defined. Two people come together for their mutual whatever consent. As long as they're together, they're married. And when anyone decides to leave, they're no longer married. This I found in an interesting book was apparently the way of doing things in ancient Egypt. Now, ancient Egypt is going to come up a few times in The Wayward Woman as a place of licentiousness, as a place of moral degradation. But the way it's described here by Professor Janet Johnson is interesting. It was no-fault divorce, and she calls it serial monogamy. You just go from one person to another person to another person. You would be married, but if for any reason either party finds it no longer satisfactory, they leave and it's over. It sounds a lot like today. It sounds like the kind of easy come, easy go relationship of marriage that has a lot of freedom to it, but has a problem in how loose it is. So that's one pull. On the other pull is a statement made out of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 5. It has been said, says Matthew, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. Actually, this is quoting Jesus himself. So here, the New Testament is quoting the idea of a certificate of divorce, that we have a get. We have a bill of divorce, a written document that sends it away, that terminates a marriage. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. Meaning, you divorce your wife for less than, you've both decided, there's no infidelity, but you've both decided you no longer want to be married. There's a divorce. Whoever that woman goes on to marry afterwards, that is an adulterous relationship. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. This is the other pull. This is saying that a marriage is eternal. You may formally terminate it, but that does not end the relationship. That there is no termination of the relationship, of the sexual union of a man and a woman. Nothing can be done about that. So whether the Protestants find a way to allow for divorce and the Catholics don't, either way, it is tainted that the divorce does not fully disconnect one party from the other. One, I want to say, is the ethic of utility. It's the freedom pull. Two is the ethic of idealizing a marriage. It is eternal. It is forever. It is unbreakable. To death do us part. Is recited at a Christian wedding under the vows. And in between these two pulls comes a Jewish marriage. And the concept is somewhere between utility and idealized is the ketubah, is a contract, which I want to formalize as saying legal grounds, that a wedding is a legal arrangement. It's a contract. It's a commitment. It's a commitment for good reasons. There's utility to it. There's also something idealized about it. It should be. We try to make it forever. We try to make it something for which we put everything into. We invest ourselves fully in it, but it can be broken. It can be terminated. And when it's terminated, it's completely terminated. There is no hold from the man on the woman or the woman on the man following the legal termination of a wedding. And however idealized it should be, you should be committed for it even beyond short-term utility, even beyond what you need right now. You're committed to an idea, to the institution, to the marriage. Nonetheless, if it no longer serves the purpose it's meant to serve, it's become too onerous for whatever reason, divorce is an option. If we look at the way the Torah talks about taking a wife, this is a verse we saw last week, Ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a wife. That is the technical learning of betrothal. And it's actually just a case on the way to talking about divorce. When it talks about divorce, it says very specifically, the key point is he's going to write the special bill of divorce and give it in her hands. There has to be something legal, contractual about it. And that is the key point. And then he sends her out of the house. It is asymmetrical. I recognize that, and I recognize the problematic nature of that. I will say, you know, I've come to appreciate the Torah's morality here in terms of marriage and divorce very much in a human frame. I can't say that it's completely consonant with the way that we look at things today. And this asymmetry is one of the big concerns, but we're going to bracket that for today. It is something that I can, at a different occasion, talk about. I'm not sure we'll get into it in the fourth case, but just hold that for a moment. One of the big points that we will talk about, one of the major points we say we really will address, this asymmetry. We will talk very carefully and fully about the recourse that a woman has inside of a marriage that she wants out of. And that's going to be a big, big topic. But in this case, he sends her away. But my main point that I want to talk about here is verse 2. When she has departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. In other words, the key point of divorce is to free a woman up to go ahead and marry someone else. And that it's really important in the consciousness of divorce that the man who is choosing, or the woman who's also choosing in ways that we'll talk about, understands that it's in order to marry someone else. The point is that it's comparative. And this is point one of this idea of a sexual field that I want to talk about. When a person is in a marriage, a person is completely invested in that marriage. A person is not checking out the other options, person considering what might be. For a marriage to succeed, it has to be with commitment and investment. Nonetheless, because divorce is an honest and specific option, the idea in the background that a person might have better options, that a person need not be trapped in a marriage which is not good, that if divorce is a possibility, the background field of possibilities are always present. And the duality of consciousness that a person has to be committed to, I am here committed to this marriage, and yet I am aware of possibilities. That's idea of a sexual field number one. This idea is anti-romantic. And if someone sort of stops to consider a Jewish wedding, how we offer a ring, and then we pause and we read the marriage contract. And the marriage contract is all about the conditions and the conditions of divorce. How anti-romantic. Arranged marriages, take all the Romans out. It's all about this sort of legal language. I would like people to appreciate how good this is, how much is gained by taking away the mystery, the arbitrary feelings, and speaking very practically, legally about terms and conditions to provide a groundwork, a foundation on which romance and love and emotions can sprout in the most healthy manner possible. That's my argument for Jewish marriage. Let's go on. Okay, now we're going to dive into the wayward woman. We're going to briefly look over the sources and talk about it both in the Torah, the written law, and in the Mishnah, in the oral law, in order to understand what's going on over here. But first of all, one more thought about a different kind of field. I'm going to stop to the next one for a second. Bilam was a prophet who was hired by King Balak to curse the Jews. But he took a high vantage point and looked out upon the beautiful encampment of Israel, and said those famous words, "How goodly are your tents, O Israel, O Jacob." Ma tovu olecha Yaakov. What was it that he saw that excited him so, that impressed him so? So the Midrash in Bava Batra 60a says that he saw that all of their tents were aligned such that each entranceway did not look into the entranceway of the next tent. In other words, people had discreet and privacy, and people were able to have their relations in their home and kept to their own business. And this is why the Shekhinah rested upon them. I would like to add another layer to this, which is when you're in a camp and you have your tents, despite the fact that your tent opening is looking at the back of the next tent, you still have some awareness of what's going on in the tents around you. That field, that awareness of what is transpiring around you is part of this delicate idea of a sexual field. Again, I want to be very careful. Promiscuity and privacy and peeping Tom, all those are absolutely outlined, and we're not talking about that. I'm talking about a kind of a background awareness. It's an Israeli question when you drive up with a new car or you rent a new house. Hey, how much did you pay for that? It's not very acceptable among Americans, but Israelis are very quick to ask, how much did you pay for that? And as a North American myself, I shrink back from the question and say, it's none of your business. But I want to defend my fellow Israelis and their desire to ask, what did you pay for that? Because if you know how much money your neighbors sold your house for, that means something about how much your house is worth. It means something about what you can get for it. If you know how much somebody paid for a night in a hotel, that means something about what you should pay for a night in a hotel. And I can attest, I know I bring my family in a little bit. I have another daughter who is currently on what's called Shvila Humus. It's the Humus Trail. It's traveling all across the Far East with a whole bunch of Israelis, but most important is the WhatsApp group. And on the Humus Trail, when you come to a guest house and you let it be known that you're Israeli, you get a better price than the average person off the street. That's because Israelis are conscious of how much you paid for that, of what something's worth. They know they constitute a market. They know they are present inside of a market. And they know that every transaction affects every other transaction. This is true for money, and it's true for mating. It's true for how attractive does a husband have to be for someone to want to marry him? What's the average earning potential that puts you at the mid-level, at the top level, at the bottom level? What about attractiveness? What about willingness to have children? What about a whole host of other questions that when people are deciding on a lifetime mate, someone to build a family with, there are market standards. There are things against which we compare each other to. And that awareness is the second piece of the sexual field. Okay, that sets up the background. We jump into the idea of the wayward woman. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them, we're in Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 4. If any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man lies with her carnally and is hidden from the eyes of her husband and is kept close, and she is defiled, and there is no witnesses against her, and she isn't caught in the act, and the spirit of jealousy comes on him, and he's jealous of his wife, and she is defiled, or. Now this or means there's another possibility, and the Torah's framing of these things feels like it's leaving these different possibilities kind of hanging. But it's a particular language of how you phrase an oath of two different conditional possibilities. What's important is that the two conditions exist. Or if the spirit of jealousy comes on him and he's jealous of his wife and she isn't defiled, meaning we've begun with the mind of the husband. He is sure that his wife has committed adultery under him, but it's clear that she isn't caught. There's no witnesses. So how sure can he be? He has a suspicion. This speaks to the problem. Sexuality is by definition private. Sexuality is by definition happening inside of a black box. And that black box is very critical. That's what allows husband and wife to explore, to do things without anybody else's scrutiny, to be utterly and totally focused on each other. Nobody's eyes, no one's presence is there. And that is the goal of a healthy Jewish sexuality, to be completely focused on each other, something we talked about in a previous shiur. But here it becomes a problem, because the possibility of infidelity is almost always hidden from the eyes of people. So all we know about is a certain jealousy. What you do about that jealousy, knowing that people can be unfaithful and most likely will never be caught. And so this is the problem framed and where the wayward woman comes in. The procedure. There's more to it that we'll talk about when we introduce the Mishnah. But in terms of just reading through the verses, the man then brings his wife to the priest. So this thing happens at the temple. There's a specific offering, which is a sort of degraded offering. It doesn't have oil. It doesn't have the regular frankincense. The offering is put in the hands of the woman. There's holy water, which is taken, and dust is put into it. And then the priest dishevels the woman, undoes her hair publicly, puts it into her hands, and that opens up the oath. The oath is said as followed. The priest shall cause her to swear and shall tell the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you haven't gone aside to uncleanness, being under your husband, meaning the only question of uncleanness or defilement is that she's done something while under her husband. Premarital sex is not the concern here. This is only whether she's been unfaithful, not whether or not she has come into the marriage as a non-virgin or not. Then you will be free from this water of bitterness that brings a curse. But if you have gone astray, being under your husband, again, under your husband is very critical, and if you are defiled, and some man has lain with you and besides your husband. You see that if the two possibilities without actually laying them out, that's sort of the nature of the construct here. Then the priest shall cause the woman to swear with the oaths of cursing. And the priest shall tell the woman, may Hashem make you a curse and an oath among your people when Hashem allows your thigh to fall away and your body to swell. There are two locations, the thigh and the belly, one referring to the sexual attractiveness, the other talking about the location of birth. Both are going to be afflicted. And this water that brings a curse will go into your bowels and make your body swell and your thigh fall away. The woman shall say, amen, amen, meaning I've heard, I understand the conditions, I know this is a test, I understand the two possibilities, and I accept them. The Mishnah will go on to elaborate that she's accepted with her amen, amen, lots of things that have to do with the fact that she is truly free of any infidelity. The priest shall write this curse in a book, and he shall blot them out into the water of bitterness. This actual curse, including God's name, is written on a scroll. And we learn many of the ideas of safrut, the special calligraphy that happens here. We also understand many of the special things about when Hebrew has to be used. And this is here. This has to be in Hebrew. It has to be written like a Torah scroll. And then it is scraped off and the ink is put into this water. She takes the offering and she drinks the waters. What is the symbolism here? It's so powerful, and there's much, much to be said. I simply want to focus on this idea that there is a book here, a scroll, a sefer, and it is being destroyed in order to save this marriage. And many times the Torah makes the homily that the peace of a household, which we're trying to affect by this sota, we're trying to reconcile the husband and the wife, either to confirm his suspicions and send her away, or to deny his suspicions and have them come back together. The hope is that the ambiguity, the question mark, is dealt with, and that this couple comes back together. And the rabbis make the homily that the peace of a household is so important that it merits the erasure of God's name. That we take a scroll with God's name on it, and if you know in Jewish tradition how careful it is, we will never erase God's name. We will bury it rather than destroy it. Here we actually are destroying a scroll with God's name on it in order to address the suspicions and the tension that has entered this mission, this marriage. And again, there are two resolutions: either divorce, they should be disconnected, or reconciliation. But living in a marriage with suspicions is not a tentative position, and so we have to do something. The legalities, the bill of divorce, and the marriage contract, and the sota scroll are all of a piece. The point of marriage is to have the sacrosanct, the holy nature of the scroll, of the commitment, of the contract, to stay elevated. How important that contract is. And something has happened in this sota marriage where we believe the contract has been taken less seriously, and we are embodied it, symbolizing it by scratching out the contract and making her drink the results. The results. When he's made her to drink the water, then it shall happen. If she is defiled and has committed a trespass against her husband, that the waters that caused the curse will enter into her and become bitter, and her body will swell and her thigh fall away. And the woman will become a curse among her people. But remember, from the very beginning, the Torah has said this might be true and this might not be true. This is a true ordeal. This is really something that we're testing. Both possibilities, and despite the matter of the husband's conviction, how convinced he is, he's willing to go to the temple, spare no expense in going all the way with this, he might be wrong. And that is not only held open all the way through, but verse 28, if the woman isn't defiled, but is clean, then she shall be free and she shall conceive seed. This conceiving seed is seen to be actually a blessing. If she's been infertile, she will conceive. If she's had children, she will have more children. If her children have been of a certain quality, that quality will improve. This is the law of jealousy. When a wife being under her husband goes astray and is defiled, or when the spirit of jealousy comes on a man and he's jealous of his wife, then he shall set the woman before Hashem, and the priest shall execute on her all this law. He will do this thing, and she will be proven to be innocent or guilty. The man shall be free from iniquity. From what's the iniquity? From causing this. Let's say she dies. Let's say she's found guilty. People will want to blame the husband. How could you have done such a thing? So from the fact that he wanted clarity or assisted in clarity, that's not going to be his problem. And she shall bear her iniquity for bringing this to pass. Okay. This shall conceive seed is going to be a really important point that we're going to come back to. Okay. You may be familiar, and if not, there is a famous midrash whereby the mother Hannah uses the sota legalities to her own benefit. If you remember, Hannah is the mother of Shmuel, the prophet Samuel. She would go up to the temple and not be able to conceive. She was bitterly distressed about this. Her second wife, Peninnah, had lots of children. Her husband, Elkanah, tried to assuage her pain and says, aren't I better to you than 10 children? And she says, no, I want to be able to be a mother. She goes up to the temple, up to the tabernacle at Shiloh. She pours out her heart. The priest looks at her. And again, the vision of the priest over here is going to be ever present, right? The priest who looks at Hannah and who looked at the sota woman and accuses her of being drunk. And she says, no, I'm just so upset, so distraught that I'm pouring out my heart. It is from Hannah that we learn all sorts of laws of how to pray properly, how to use your lips, how to speak so you are just about audible. She's the model of prayer. And she goes to the temple, and the sages put the following words into her. She says to God, Imroa tira, if you see me and see my my pain, good. Then you will certainly answer my prayer. But if you don't see me, then I'm going to do something. I'm going to take matters into my own hands. She said, I will go and I will seclude myself with another man before Elkanah, my husband. This will trigger the sota incident. I will do something that makes myself into a sota. Elkanah will be forced to take me to the temple to drink the sota waters. I will be innocent because I will not have committed adultery. And I will then be blessed. I will have children. I will take this whole sota thing as a weapon to use against God, against my husband, so that I will become fertile. What is going on? How could Chazal conceive as the mother of prayer threatening to become a sota? That changes the whole thing. It's something, in a certain sense, certainly here it's being portrayed as something advantageous to the woman. And I'd like to play that out. Okay. Just to understand the process quickly, I'm not sure how much of the technicalities we're going to get to. I'm watching my time carefully here. For a sota to happen, for it to be triggered, several stages have to happen. There has to be jealousy established, which means it has to be formal. This is not a whim. This is not something that the husband, you know, feels inside. This is legal system. And so the husband formally says before witnesses so that it can be recorded and made a legal structure. He says to her, I forbid you to be alone with that man. The person is specified. Again, a woman, a man also is forbidden to be alone in a room with a married person. That's the construct of yichud that we have of being alone and secluded. It's a really important geder or buffer that we have so that there'd be no suspicion of wrongdoing. It's quite amazing to my mind that Vice President Vice President Pence adopted this. Many HR companies put it into the code that men and women aren't to be alone in a room together. It's standard practice in the Israeli military. And it's all going back to those rabbis way back when who we think are prudish or overly concerned or hypersensitive. Turns out they were right on the money that being alone is a good thing to observe because we don't want the appearance of sin. We don't want opportunity to lead things. However, a person is generally alone, not allowed to be alone with somebody. But being alone with somebody, even in front of witnesses, does not constitute a serious offense. If, however, the man says, I forbid you to be alone with so-and-so, and then, point number two, in defiance of that clearly articulated, witnessed prohibition, the wife goes ahead and does it. She is alone with this person. That is how the sota procedure is triggered. Until that happens, until there are witnesses that talk about the kina has happened and the stira has happened, the seclusion has happened, there is no drinking of the sota waters. What happens with the sota waters? They travel to the temple. They prepare this special offering. The priests go ahead and warn the woman. The oath is administered. It is then scratched off and put into the water. She imbibes the oath. And then whatever happens, happens. Let's go and see this inside the Mishnah. I'm going to kind of run through this carefully, but it's really important that you see how this gets legislated. We're back at the first stage, kina, the establishment of jealousy, okay? It's a formal thing. He issues a warning, says, do not speak with the man called so-and-so. And she nevertheless spoke with him. So the fact that she's warned against speaking with him is not an issue. You cannot forbid her to speak to someone. So she's still permitted. This does not trigger the sota response. If, however, she entered into a secluded place and remained with him long enough to be defiled, that triggers the sota response. At that point, the man and woman are considered to be in an ambiguous state, perhaps on their way to divorce, perhaps on their way to reconciliation. But in that ambiguous space, they may not sleep together anymore. He is forbidden to her. She is forbidden to him. They may not be together. If she is a Kohen, at that point, if she is married to a Kohen, at that point, she can't eat of the special Kohen food. She's basically been in a quasi-divorce state. Okay. This is the key point. After Kina Vestira, after designating the seclusion, the man, and forbidding her to be alone with him, and she goes and does it, there is the opportunity to take her to drink the bitter waters. These are the people that don't drink, says the Mishnah 4:2. They don't drink and they don't collect payment of their ketubah. I'll come back to that. A woman who confesses and says, I am defiled. She says, she admits. She says, I had relations with this man. Then divorce happens. She's forbidden to her husband. She's forbidden to her paramour. She can marry somebody else. The marriage is terminated, and she does not collect her ketubah. A woman for whom she does not admit, but witnesses come and testify to the fact that she has been defiled. Or a woman who says, I will not drink. It is her choice. She cannot be forced to drink. She doesn't have to admit guilt. All she has to say is, I will not drink. Or her husband who says, you know what? I prefer not to make her drink. Or, this is great, a husband and wife who engage in sexual intercourse on the way to the temple. In this case, the last two, meaning the man says, I will not have her drink, or they engage in sexual intercourse on the way to the sota ceremony. In those two cases, the man is responsible for having her not collect her payment, and therefore she does collect the ketubah payment. So let's understand. A woman is able to exit a marriage by going down this sota route and only refusing to drink. She forfeits her ketubah, but she gets out of the marriage. So this is the key point that I'd like to suggest. It is, I admit, somewhat radical, perhaps uncommon. I'm not familiar of a source on this, but I'm putting things together and I'd like to say the following. A woman is in a bad marriage. Her husband is not treating her properly, not treating her well. And we're living in a certain field, I said, where options are available and options are known. And a woman like Hannah, right? I want to say that this is something that can be used to a woman's advantage. Her boss, her neighbor, someone down the way says, you're really not treated well. You really don't deserve the way that is what's happening over there. And they develop a relationship. They don't do anything illicit, but there's an understanding, and I'm telling a story here to make a point. Imagine we're living in a time where polygamy is permitted, where this could be, you know, a single available person, or this could be even somebody who has already a marriage and is willing to embrace another woman in his marriage. The point is, the woman knows that she can leave and be to another person. And it's much better for her in this new place. And so she goes ahead and makes her husband jealous. She says, you know how well so-and-so treats me? You know what so-and-so does after work with his earnings? He goes to the Beis Medrash and learns Torah. And you're a bum and you go and you gamble all the time. And this makes the husband jealous, upset. He's being compared. He's being compared unfavorably. He's being held to a standard which is not his own. He's being told that you are not up to snuff. And he says, you can't talk to that guy anymore. I don't like that. And she says, okay. And then she goes ahead and she's alone with him. And that triggers the sota. She says, I'm not drinking the sota waters. He says, he says, there's a divorce that has to happen. She exits. She loses her ketubah. But that financial penalty, in a certain sense, could be offset or doesn't matter, because the much larger picture is she has an option that she can go to. This is dangerous. This is a really dangerous game to play. This is a really uncomfortable thing to put in and to suggest that the Torah may or may not be aware of. And I'd like to say it's inevitable. I don't think it's played out as bluntly, as explicitly as I just described it, but in a subtle way, in terms of sexual fields and people being aware of options and what jealousy does and how jealousy should, and I want to make this clear, the better option is the husband gets his stuff together. The husband steps up his game. He understands he might lose this wonderful partner unless he acts better, unless he behaves better, that he doesn't have exclusive, irrevocable rights to this woman. She's a free agent. The possibility of terminating this divorce is real. And unless he continues to do the things he needs to do to deserve this person, he may not have her. And so the fact that marriage is somewhere in between utility and idealized, that divorce remains an option, but not a flippant option, not an easy option, not something that you wake up one day and say, you know what, I can do better. See around, I'm going to go check out. This duality of consciousness, of being able to say, this marriage is very important. It's a legal binding. It's everything right now, but it doesn't have to be permanent if it falls below a threshold of legal reasons to go ahead and terminate it. Okay, that's the theory. The process is, and a few points that kind of, I think, play into my idea is, when they go up to the temple, the Torah scholars have to send guards with them. Why? Lest they sleep together. Why are we worried they're going to sleep together? They're in a terrible fight. He's accused her of infidelity. Well, the point is argued. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, we can trust those two together. But Chazal in the Mishnah here was already well aware of, I would say, the heightened attraction caused by this possibility. There's a lot of discussion, and my wife is much more versed in these sort of things, about things like mating in captivity. How do you keep monogamy alive? And there's an important point of recognizing that a long-term relationship can't be taken for granted, and that the dangers or the immediacy of keeping it alive is really critical. And I think this sota story is part of it, that the jealousy all of a sudden has this other issue of, we are all of a sudden worried that those two are going to sleep together. Onwards. Here's the next stage. They warn her, and they're actually sort of good cop and bad cop here. They're trying to say things like, we understand. Oh my goodness, I'm so out of time. I'm going to skip through this. I need to get to one more point at the end. Wow. Okay. This idea of sexual fields and the value of a woman and possibilities gets played out not only inside the marriage, inside a community, but I want to say gets played out in terms of assimilation and decline. What am I saying? If a woman plays this game too much, then the value of marriage degrades. And this is not something the Sota operation to take lightly. And my argument is the point of Sota is to make sure that this is done only in the rarest of occasions, and that the intensity of it remains so that people don't play this game. Okay. This has a really important implication on the cultural field. The Mishnah at the end of the tractate of Mishnah Sota says that when adulterers proliferated, the performance of the ritual of bitter waters was nullified. It meant exactly this. When people were taking advantage of this, when the idea of marriage became degraded such that it wasn't as sacrosanct as it should be, then this whole thing of Sota stopped working. Now the Mishnah goes on to this whole discussion about how our society generally degraded. The taste of fruit has been removed. Taste and was down after the destruction of the temple, meaning the Mishnah is talking about leaving Sota behind and talking about what happens after the destruction of the temple. One of the things that happened is taste in fruit declined. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says the aroma and taste has been lost. The sages said promiscuity and witchcraft has consumed everything. I have an idea here that I want to try to get across. What's promiscuity and witchcraft? It's the intensity of desire, the way we buy experience. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll is what we would say about these two things today. A way of getting the highs of a healthy sexual relationship, bypassing it. When people opt for all the things that replace excitement, ecstasy, in ways that don't have them ensconced inside a healthy sexual relationship, then everything gets degraded, and even the pleasure of fruit gets lost. The last Mishnah really talks about this terrible decline of Jewish society, impudence, chutzpah, yasge. People become so chutzpahdik. The families fall apart, daughters rising up against their mothers, sons disgracing their fathers, meaning the whole integrity of the preciousness of a human society ends up falling apart, and everybody seeks out their own interest. But here's the point I'm building towards. Mishnah says this a little bit earlier, that at the time of Roman persecution, the sages said our beauty, our attractiveness has to come inside. We have to contain ourselves. We have to dial down our attractiveness, and so that women in palanquins would not parade before their wedding days like they did beforehand. And this is my coup de grace. This is the most incredible Mishnah. In the war or the pulmus, which means perhaps the debates of Vespasian, we're talking about the destruction of the Roman destruction of the Second Temple, 70 CE. They banned bridegrooms from wearing crowns. Again, our outward beauty has to come inside and taken off our crowns. And the playing of drums, or some say flutes. In the War of Titus, they banned brides wearing crowns. So first men brought their sexuality inside, and then women brought their sexuality inside. And they stopped teaching their children Greek. Meaning the ability to use outward culture for advantage end up being something that made that outward culture too attractive, and people were degraded in their attractiveness, and so we had to diminish. The word for flute or drum, the word that this is being used here to talk about sexuality that has to be banned, in Hebrew, the word is eros. In the very same Mishnah that is talking about don't teach your children Greek, the Hebrew word for eros appears. And this, I think, completes a huge insight. Sexuality is an important way in which we improve society. The selectiveness that we use to find the best mates, the best fathers and mothers for our future children, is a good thing that needs to be encouraged. That process should be somewhat unfettered. But heightened competition, or competition over short-term me interests, which trump long-term higher interests like my family, my children, the Jewish people, assimilation, when eros is used for good, it's helpful. When eros is degraded so that our choices are, we're not attracted to our own people, we're not attracted to our own language, we're not attracted to a good Jewish woman, example of all the values that we stand for, our own daughters, our own wives are no longer as valuable as those beautiful Greek women, those beautiful French women that seem to be more attractive because of short-term superficial interests. So then we have to contain the level of sexual competition that we might do otherwise. This is an amazing clip that says exactly that from West Side Story.
As long as you're in my house.
This ain't your house. She pays rent here, same as me and you.
This is about family. Tú tienes que respetar.
Ah, y ahora yo no soy parte de la familia. ¿Y por qué?
¿Porque soy prieta?
Eso, eso no es lo que quise decir, bueno, Anita. Eso
no,
María, que te prohíbo ver a ese estúpido Polak.
Maybe Chino and your friends fall down at your feet. And maybe you scare the Americanos when you make fists and angry faces. Pero yo no estoy interesada ni en boxeo, ni en peleas. Y tú no eres mi jefe. And I am not interested in what you have to say.
Amárrame eso.
Okay. Here's my punchline. Believing that your culture is attractive. Again, if you're familiar with West Side Story, and if you're familiar with the remake that Spielberg and, Miranda, what's his name? You know out there. The new remake, they went back and they redid West Side Story, and they did it with 30% Spanish. 30% Spanish, so that Spanish people will feel like they're speaking their own language. And the fact that she says at the end, I'm not interested in what you say, is a much larger statement saying that English people aren't interested in hearing or appreciating the Spanish. And the Spanish people aren't interested in appreciating the English, that we want language for ourselves. Appreciating our own culture, valuating it between the competitions of the possibilities there is the infidelity of assimilation. Thinking that something other than your wonderful wife that you have, or your wonderful husband that you have, that you can find something better out there, which is being provided by a sexual field, which is valuating other things. That is the larger picture that I think is being expressed here in The Wayward Woman. And it's really the danger that we have to guard against. I get really upset whenever I see out there in Israel where things are being advertised specifically and exclusively in English. I think immediately of the problem of why don't you hold your own language, your own people, the beauty of what your own culture is to be the most valuable thing out there. I think we have to guard ourselves against that. And I hope I've shown how that is part and parcel of the kind of competition that we find where our sexual value is being set against our cultural standing and how those things interact. Okay, thank you very much. We're going to pause now. I know I went just a tad over time. I'm going to look at the questions in the chat now, but this is already overtime, and I thank you all for your participation. If you do have a moment, and you can, it would be valuable if you let me know in the chat whether I succeeded or did not succeed in changing your impression of the wayward woman or not. That's my question. Excuse me a second. I'm just having trouble getting my camera back on. I have to log out of something else. Give me a moment. Okay. I think I'm back here. Yeah, there we go. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Again, if you are open to saying something about whether I succeeded in changing your impression about the Sota ordeal. But meanwhile, I'm going to take a look at what's happening here in the chat. Okay. Negative reaction for sure. Wait. I do want to make it clear that in the Sota reaction that if the woman is guilty, the waters cause her to distend and blow up, and her paramour as well. They both are punished with that. That's the understanding. But what about the man who accuses his innocent wife? So it has to be understood that the wife is not completely innocent. She has and has to legally have heard the fact that she's been singled out from being alone with this particular man, and then goes ahead and defies that ban. And other than that, there is no sota. So there is necessarily some guilt. Whether you feel that that's sufficient for this, that's a fair question. But it is important in the way that it's structured that it's not completely innocent. Is not good for now.
Excuse me. That was not my question. My question was, yes, she does all of the things, etc., and she goes and she drinks and she doesn't die.
Right.
It is proven that she is innocent.
Right.
You didn't tell us what the Talmud says about what happens to the husband.
Nothing.
Not nothing. He's forbidden to accuse her in the future.
Okay. Fair point. Thank you. Thank you. Good. But the point was they get back together and hopefully that's been resolved and that's the hope is that they bring each other to a better marriage afterwards. If she survives, how is the man who made a wrongful accusation punished in a modern day context? So wrongful accusations is something which is certainly something that the Torah deals with. It's a different context. There's something called motzi shemra, a man who makes improper allegations against his wife that are shown to be false. There's a penalty along with that, and there's a part of the Torah that deals with that particular issue. I don't know if this really addresses it. Okay, we'll leave that for now. Okay, I'm going forward in the chat still. Okay, so you mentioned David and Bathsheba. I know. That's certainly a question for later, but yes, that's certainly in the background here. Yeah, there's a whole point that I skipped through. There's a lot that I didn't do. And the idea that this really complicated case that the Mishnah addresses the fact that a a woman may not be, she may not die immediately because she has some extra merits, even though she's actually guilty. And how her extra merits actually complicate the clarity that the sota ordeal is supposed to put in. And so that the ordeal is not nearly as cut and dry as we might think. Sometimes we say it takes a year or 2 years, the Mishnah says, or 3 years before it actually takes place. So there's something honest about the fact that even afterwards, questions linger. And it's not easy once suspicions have come into a marriage to simply dispel them. And I think the Mishnah is actually honest about how that's how that's part of the problem. I'm going to go a little further. I don't know if I can do everything today. I need to cut this a little bit short. Okay. Okay. We're going to call it here. I'm sorry. There's been a lot of good questions. I will definitely read the entire chat afterwards. And we will come back next week with a conclusion. And I do think it will be I'll be able to bring in some of the things that we talked about today and address some of the questions that you still have. I'm sorry for the out of time, but thank you very much for your attention today.